President Trump authorized deployment of troops to Chicago this weekend after a federal agent shot an allegedly armed motorist there. This comes as a federal judge blocked a separate attempt by the president to send the military into Portland, as we have been reporting.
Welcome to Red Meat and to a new day in America. Today we're talking about justice, the department, and the concept as James Comey faces charges, Pam Bondi faces down the Senate, and President Donald Trump squares off against crime-ridden cities. Here's more on Trump's effort to get troops in Chicago.
Chicago, there was a raid just last night of an apartment building by ICE officials. 37 undocumented immigrants were hauled away. In Portland, it's unclear, you know, what precipitated this. There have been people protesting outside of ICE headquarters in Portland. The military is used to protect the homeland, from enemies typically abroad. But as the president made very, very clear in a speech to military leaders last week, in his view, the most important job for the military now is to fight what he says the battle for the with the enemy within. And, you know, he leaves that a bit undefined. The lefty lunatics who have, in his view, ruined cities like San Francisco. It's protesters in Los Angeles, in Portland. It's the crime wave through Chicago and Baltimore and Washington, D.C. And it doesn't seem to matter. The statistics do not bear out that there is any kind of new crisis. The president is doing this. And this is what's confusing, Steve, is that, typically that is not only not within their job description, but there are certain laws that prevent that. At the same time, the military serves at the pleasure of the commander in chief, and that is Donald Trump. And when he orders them to jump, they're supposed to jump.
Attorney General Pam Bondi was supposed to be in the hot seat in a Senate hearing this week, but instead of jumping when she was told to, the AG flipped the script. Here's the Mark Reardon Show at KFTK Radio with more.
Back at all. This is one of my favorite moments. So this is Senator Padilla. Remember Padilla? He was the one that stormed Kristi Noem when she was doing the event out in California. He didn't have a suit on or any identification that he was a member of the United States Senate. He tried to make a big media spectacle of it. So Pam Bondi kind of remembered that when Senator Padilla, he's also the guy that clipped Eric Schmidt at the congressional baseball game. He hit him and he was pitching that night. But here's Pam Bondi having a little fun with Senator Padilla this morning. Whatever.
General Bondi, you are the Attorney General of the United States. Director Patel reports to you. Do you believe he's doing a good job, yes or no?
I believe Director Patel is doing a great job. You know where he is right now, Senator Padilla? You asked me a question.
Yes,
Director Patel right now is in Chicago, Senator
Durbin,
fighting to keep Chicago.
You said it earlier in the hearing, and yes, I have been paying attention.
You know, you want order in here now, yet you stormed the Director of Homeland Security, Kristi Noem. You sure didn't have order that day, did you, Senator?
Attorney General, you are under oath. I did not storm the secretary.
Yeah, you did.
That video has been released, I believe. Very
much. No fear from Pam Bondi there, right?
And the hearing took a turn that the Democrats had probably not anticipated. When talk turned from Trump to the last administration and their subversive surveillance. Here's more from Reardon's show.
I'll tell you what, I became a much bigger fan of Pam Bondi today, because she had a hearing on Capitol Hill. Now, there's a couple of things happening at the same time here. And, you know, she was asked about a variety of topics. I would say that Senator Hawley didn't grill the attorney general as much as make a statement, because yesterday, let me kind of wind these things together here. There was a story that cleared while we were on the air about Jack Smith, the special prosecutor who went after Trump, and the things that he did in relation to members of the Senate, mainly. There's one House member, one congressman that was tracked as well, but they had their phones tracked, and the FBI was looking at their locations. That's what Senator Hawley says right now, in addition to phone records. Now, I thought what Senator Hawley said was pretty remarkable this morning. I really did. The one thing that I would caution people, and I've heard this soundbite a couple of times, he at one point yesterday, maybe he said it this morning, said that they were tapping our phones. They were not listening to the phone calls. Okay, there is a distinction. I'm not arguing what they did here is any better than that, but it wasn't like the FBI was listening to the phone calls of the members of the legislature, but they were tracking them. They were trying to figure out what messages were coming in, and then they were tracking them to, find out what they were doing in the aftermath of January 6th. So he goes off on this morning.
I've been listening closely in this hearing, and I've heard over and over from my Democrat colleagues concerns about targeting political enemies, and they've accused you of all manner of things and the current president. I've also heard them said, and I just wrote it down because I wanted to be sure I heard it correctly. I've heard them say that Joe Biden never targeted his political enemies. Joe Biden never directed his attorney general to target his political opponents. Huh. That's interesting, because I could have sworn that yesterday we learned that the FBI tapped my phone. Let's look at it.
All right. So again, they didn't tap his phone. Just to be clear here, it's a little different than listening in to phone calls, but that does not make his moment before, you know, the Senate committee and Pam Bondi less effective.
We've got a list. Tap my phone. Tap Lindsey Graham's phone. Tap Marsha Blackburn's phone. Tap five other phones of United States senators. Gee, it sure looks like targeting political opponents to me, and yet I haven't heard a word from that side of the dais about any concern whatsoever. We've got nothing but concerns today, but no concern at all for a Justice Department that is tapping the phones of sitting United States senators because who knows why.
Now, again, I think this would have been more effective, and you know what the media is going to do. They're already doing it. I see it on Twitter out there. They're correcting Senator Hawley. They're not addressing the real issue. Like, if you go to the Washington Post, the New York Times, and the traditional legacy outlets right now, there's barely a mention of this story. They've all done stories, but you kind of have to search them out. If you just put in Jack Smith into a search engine, I know this because I did it a short time ago, there won't be a lot of stories that come up from the New York Times and the traditional outlets that are focusing on this particular issue. I think he would have had better luck here if he would have said tracking and not tapping, because that's more accurate and it gives the Democrats and others, you know, the ability to say, no, you're wrong about this, Josh.
They don't like them. They're members of the opposition party. They're Republicans. They're conservatives. You've seen this document, Attorney General Bondi. Well, what was going on here? Who ordered this? Who ordered the tapping of the phones of United States senators?
Senator Hawley, I cannot discuss the details of that right now for very good reason.
You're going to do a thorough investigation into this, I trust. Is that correct?
We will be looking at all aspects of this, and I have talked to Director Patel at length about
and
this.
And you're going to figure out who was involved in this, who signed off on it, who knew about it. You're going to get to the bottom of all of it. Is it correct?
Yes, and I've spoken to Director Patel about it, and he is committed to doing this.
So I think you have to, you know, certainly look into this. This is a legitimate story, but there's a big difference between tapping and listening in on phone calls and tracking and, you know, seeing what messages were coming in. Again, I think both are questionable to be done by the Justice Department, targeting members of the United States Senate and Congress. When all this kind of came out yesterday, you had some of the, you know, the allegations that were made by some other members of Congress, including Ron Johnson from Wisconsin.
This is outrageous what has happened. I just want to give you a timeline of this. I think you've already got the FBI sheet that shows the number of members of Congress that were targeted. Representative Kelly, Senators Graham, Hagerty, Hawley, Sullivan, Tuberville, myself, Senator Lummis, and Blackburn. Now, this memo was dated September of 2023. To put it all into context, the Mar-a-Lago raid occurred in August of 2022. Jack Smith announced the indictments against President Trump in August of 2023. So this is almost 2 months later. They're casting this net, this fishing expedition against members of the Senate and the House?
Yeah, so he's kind of trying to establish the timeline there. Here's Ron Johnson today.
It should shock, it should outrage every American. Quite honestly, by now, it should be obvious to every American that it's not the Republicans that are a threat to our democracy. It's President Obama, it's President Biden, it's the radical leftists that have served and support them. This is outrageous.
So let me go back to Pat and Bondi, because a lot of this did happen. You know, there was a little crossover this morning during this hearing. And Fred, you watched a lot of it, too. I mean, she was pretty good, man. Yeah. She did not back down. So one of the stories I haven't really talked about, we'll talk about a little bit more this afternoon, is the person who tried to assassinate, or at least made threats on Brett Kavanaugh, because this whole thing is just ridiculous and the media is playing into it. So the guy who tried to kill Brett Kavanaugh is a 29-year-old man by the name of Nicholas Roski. But the rest of the media, because Nicholas has decided that he's now a woman, has played into this notion that it was a she who tried to kill Brett Kavanaugh. Here's Ted Cruz with Pam Bondi this morning.
Just this week, a left-wing Biden-appointed judge sentenced this attempted murderer, this attempted assassin, to just 8 years. The Department of Justice asked for 30 years.
That's right.
And that judge downward departed by 22 years. Why? Because this left-wing judge said that the attempted murderer was transgender. And because he identifies as transgender, apparently it's okay to try to kill a Supreme Court justice if your politics are sufficiently woke. Now, I know you have said the Department of Justice is going to appeal, and you absolutely should. I called this week. I believe this judge should be impeached.
It's ridiculous. It really is. It was an 8-year sentence.
Shh. Wait. Do you hear that? It sounds like crickets. It's all the Democrats who are calling for an investigation into questionable surveillance during Obama and Biden's administrations. Rich Scioli at WPHT Radio has more thoughts on the surveillance of government officials by the Biden administration.
Now, we'll get into what happened today with the U.S. Senate. There was a lot of back and forth with the Attorney General Pam Bondi. But the big takeaway is that we're learning now that as part of Operation Arctic Frost, Republican senators were spied on by the special counsel in relation to January 6th, which, of course, is known as the high holy day of the left. Why did this happen? What was he looking for? And I mean, I remember the good old days when we were just spying on people like Carter Page and George Papadopoulos. We never imagined that the Justice Department would be spying on United States senators. And if the shoe was on the other foot, as they say, if the Trump administration was spying on Democrat senators, could you imagine the screams of authoritarianism and fascism and everything else? Could you imagine what you would be hearing out there in the streets? I mean, it would be nonstop on CNN, nonstop on MSNBC, nonstop. And it would be the kind of thing where they would say, and you'd have to drink every time you heard this, worse than Watergate. Yep. Worse than Watergate. And I also, too, think that this notion of the executive branch of government spying on the legislative branch of government in and of itself is repulsive. But to do it to eight of them, eight senators, and the president called Jack Smith a sleazebag for doing this. One of those senators went on Fox News earlier today and she just said she was shocked. She couldn't believe it. And she was spied on by Jack Smith. And then they asked her, what do you think of the president calling him a sleazebag? She said he is a sleazebag. Absolutely is a sleazebag for doing this. It's just the weaponization of government. But we're supposed to believe that the real threat is National Guard troops being sent to cities where there's all this urban unrest. Because as they said on The View today, those National Guard soldiers are actually there so that we can't have an election. Huh? I mean, that was a question I asked yesterday on the show. What's the end game here? And apparently that's it. The National Guard is being deployed to these Democrat cities so that we can't have an election, which is not until 2028. So they're going to be camping out there for a really long time. It's a long way to go. I assume they mean the presidential election. But even if it's for midterms, that's a long time. That's not for another year. They're just going to be there the whole time? Do they get bathroom breaks? Nap time? Do they get snacks? Do they get to swap in and swap out? High five somebody else to come in and just man the city while they're waiting to eventually then make sure people can't vote in the upcoming election that's 13 months away? I'm just trying to understand the playbook here. I really am. Or it's to just get us so comfortable with them being in cities. They just kind of hide like Br'er Rabbit in the briar patch. And they just wait for 3 years. Just wait. Do nothing for 3 years. And then tell everybody there's no election. I don't know. What about the primary? Can we have the primary? Do they have the primary election? What if they're in places that the primary election really doesn't matter? Like, in other words, if you're really looking to stop the election, Wouldn't you start sending the troops to South Carolina and New Hampshire and Iowa? I mean, I'm just, that's probably where you want them to be. If all of a sudden the National Guard shows up at the shed in Iowa, which is one of the must-go-to stops along the way in the presidential race, and you go, okay, I guess they're here to make sure that there won't be a primary election? And then you go to that little town in New Hampshire that always votes first for president. And so like 7 people live there or something, 13 people, whatever it is. I don't. They always say that that town is the bellwether for America. It's like a dozen people. Maybe that town. They just seize that town, and then nobody's allowed to vote, and then they don't have an election. Because we can't obviously announce the results until we know how the town of Bumble Blank, New Hampshire voted, obviously. The first in the nation election. So I'm just throwing it out there. If the playbook is, because I know people from the White House listen to the show, if the playbook really is an authoritarian takeover to prevent a presidential election 3 years from now, they should send them to the primary state. Because if you, Portland, Oregon, Oregon's not going to decide the primary, you know what I mean, for the Democrat Party? So it's not going to decide the presidential election either. That's a blue state. So then you got to, you probably want to send the National Guard to the swing states. So you can't have elections there, I would guess. I don't know. I'm just, I really don't know how any of this works because it's so stupid to even try to fantasize about this. And we've always had an election, and we've never not had an election, even in war. Even when we had a civil war, we still had a presidential election. I'm just trying to understand the mechanics of all this and how that works. And did the National Guard soldiers go polling place by polling place and confiscate the machines on their way to being put out? Or do they go and, again, it's all very strange. But that's what we're supposed to believe. So, or you could think that maybe they're there to just help fight crime. And to have a law enforcement presence so that people can attack federal law enforcement officers who are doing federal law enforcement, and the National Guard's there as per federal law to make sure that they're just able to do their job. Or it could be that, yeah, which is a lot easier to explain and in your mind, connect the dots. That's a lot easier than the idea that we're going in 3 years ahead of time. That's a head start, baby. That's a big head start. Make sure there's no election in November of 2028. Just let them hang out for 3 years in blue cities where we know the vote's going to go the Democrats anyway. So we've already kind of baked that cake in. But hey, what the heck? You know what I mean? What the heck?
Speaking of crime, here's a real human story about what happens when it runs rampant from Newell Normand at WWL Radio in New Orleans. They're discussing the case of New Orleans chef Carl Morgan, 36, who was shot and killed on September 30th during a carjacking while he waited to pick up his son from daycare. Investigators were able to track the carjacked vehicle through internal license plate readers. His vehicle was later found on the side of Interstate 10 in Metairie, Louisiana, per WDSU. Raymond Wells, the suspect in the carjacking, was found inside the stolen vehicle with a gunshot wound to the head. He's gone. But that won't bring Morgan back. He left a child without a father. Another senseless crime.
We are joined by Raphael Goyeneche, president of the Metropolitan Crime Commission. Tommy Tucker had an opportunity to interview Ralph Brennan yesterday, and they talked about Carl Morgan and this carjacking case. And you've uncovered some really disturbing revelations about this individual and about, I guess it's safe to say, the failure of the criminal justice system as it relates to this suspect or individual, I should say. The interview was tough, man. I tell you. Really tough.
But,
Tommy and Ralph did a great job laying it out. The trauma, the emotion around it. A young baby without his father. The horrific nature just goes on and on.
Right. So the only good that can come from a tragedy like this is to figure out maybe how it happened and try and determine if the system could have done anything and learn from the mistakes that were made. And this is, a classic case of why it's so critically important for the criminal justice system post-arrest to do their job and make decisions, not just what they think is the compassionate thing to do in the context of the offender, but to also make decisions that are taking into consideration the threat that some of these repeat offenders pose to themselves and the community. And my review of the perpetrator of this murder's criminal history, my opinion is he should not have been on the streets to have committed, you know, that carjacking and murder. So let me kind of go over the criminal history of Raymond Wells, who's now deceased. He took his own life, after the carjacking and murder. But in 2022, September of 2022, while he was a student in high school, he was captured on video beating up a school teacher. That's a felony under state law. So that was in September of 2022. And he was released from custody. And while he was free on bail for the battery on a school teacher, he was arrested for carrying a concealed weapon in July of 2023, which is a misdemeanor. So he got out of custody on that misdemeanor charge. And then in October of 23, he was arrested on a battery charge in municipal court, another misdemeanor. And then in February of 2024, he was arrested this time by the NOPD, carrying a concealed weapon with controlled dangerous substances, which is a second class felony, meaning that there is a mandatory minimum of 5 years. So the police department arrested him on that. They determined that the firearm that he was carrying was a stolen weapon, so they booked him on possession of stolen property. They also discovered drugs on him, and the quantities of drugs suggested that he was possessing it with intent to distribute. And then he was carrying a concealed weapon, so he was booked with that. The DA's office accepted all of those charges, so the police are operating on probable cause. They submit their report to the DA's office. The DA's office reviews the police report and assesses whether there is sufficient evidence to convict the individual of the offense for which they're being charged with. So the screening division of the district attorney's office concluded that the police department appropriately arrested him for the 95E, which is illegal carrying of a weapon while in possession of controlled dangerous substances, and that offense alone is a mandatory minimum of 5 years. On top of that, the other charges meant that he could potentially be multiple billed as an habitual offender. But let me get to that in a moment. So the DA's office accepts all those charges. So those charges were accepted. And then the battery on a police officer, battery on a school teacher and battery, and carrying a concealed weapon arrests from 2022 and 23 were concluded with guilty pleas some 4 months after his arrest on the guns and drug charges. So, in other words, he had been arrested for carrying a weapon with controlled dangerous substance, a mandatory minimum of 5 years, the drugs and the gun charges. And after he was arrested on that, he pled guilty to the battery on a school teacher and carrying a concealed weapon in June of 2024. He received 1 year suspended sentence and 1 year of inactive probation, which means that his probation was not supervised by a probation officer. He was ordered to enroll in CAFE Reconcile and an integrity program, and also seek some mental health and substance abuse treatments. So that was the disposition of the 2022 and 2023 offenses, with basically a slap on the wrist and active probation. Apparently, the court concluded that he had mental health and substance abuse issues, and they granted him an active probation with no supervision, even after he had been arrested a few months earlier on new weapons and drug charges. So he's out on the streets, you know, after he has pled guilty in June of 24, the February of 24 arrest and prosecutions were concluded with another guilty plea in May of 2025, some 4 months before he murdered Mr. Morgan during the carjacking. So in May of 2025, Raymond Wells was allowed to plead guilty to a reduced charge. The DA's office gave him a reduction. Instead of having him and charging him as carrying a weapon while in possession of drugs, they reduced that weapons charge to a misdemeanor, meaning that instead of a mandatory minimum of 5 years, he was eligible for probation and a suspended sentence. But he still pled guilty to the drugs. So obviously the police department rightfully concluded that he was in possession of a firearm and drugs, which meant it made it a mandatory minimum of 5 years. The DA's office accepted those charges, but in May of 2025, they allowed him to plead to a misdemeanor weapons charge and receive 2 years of suspended sentence and 2 years of active probation. That was 4 months before he committed the murder of Mr. Morgan during the carjacking. So the best predictor of the future is to look at the past. This is obviously a troubled individual that has a series of four arrests over a 2.5 year period of time, has not one but two felony convictions, progressing from serious to more serious. He was probated the first time, he was probated the second time, and the third time resulted in, you know, the murder of, you know, a young father, and a son is not going to have their dad, and his wife is not going to have her husband anymore because of poor decisions that were made by the prosecution and the judge. So the judge did not have to sentence this individual to a suspended sentence. That wasn't a requirement. The judge had discretion. So the judge shares some blame, but the DA's office is supposed to be representing the people of Louisiana. And Mr. Wells had criminal defense counsel, and I think that this chain of events was set into motion because the district attorney's office made a miscalculation in assessing the threats that this individual poses. Posed to the community and to himself. So, you know, this is a tragedy. The only good that can come from this tragedy is to assess what went wrong and do everything in our power to prevent it from occurring again in the future. So nobody wants to lock up people that don't pose a risk to the public, but I would argue, based on this criminal history, that the leniency that the district attorney's office gave to Mr. Wells not only did not do him any favors, it ultimately cost, you know, a young man his life, and that family will never recover from this senseless tragedy that should not have occurred, in my opinion. I believe that he should have been in custody. And if he had been sentenced, he would not have been on the streets some 4 months after his May guilty plea to commit this crime.
Thank you for listening to Red Meat, a collection of conservative audio from Odyssey's talk stations across the country. This is the place where we're not afraid to dig in, listen wherever you get podcasts, and smash that subscribe button.